Welcome to The Body Knows with Caroline Sutherland. Caroline is a medical intuitive, author, teacher, and innovative leader in the field of nutrition and energy medicine. With over 20 years' experience in the field, she can help decipher what your body is trying to tell you. And now, here's your host, Caroline Sutherland.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Body Knows. I'm Caroline Sutherland, your host of this very important program that takes place twice a month on Contact Talk Radio. I have known for a long, long time, and in fact, it's something that I see every day when I work with clients. It's the power and the debilitating effects of addictions. And in fact, I believe that addictions are the one thing that hold us back from optimum health. And there are many kinds of addictions. There's addictions to certain foods and beverages and drugs and recreational drugs and certain habits and thought patterns and, you know, overwork and overspending and all kinds of addictions. And of course, those addictions are there in our life for two things. First of all, they placate the inner child that resides within us. In other words, if we have sadness in our life, we have needs in our life, we delve into this addictive behavior, no matter what it is, to placate the wound of the inner child. Also, the addiction, in my view, serves to help us to learn and grow. And my guest on today's show is a very important guest, and I think is a great segue into introducing Candace Plator. She's a great coach, a coach that helps very much with addictions. She is a master in social work. She does something wonderful that I love called EMDR. And also now, she is the author of a wonderful book called Loving an Addict, Loving Yourself, which has won several awards for her great efforts in writing. And it's making its way now through all of the major channels that we know about, where there are agencies and individuals and counselors who are helping people with addictions. Candace, welcome to the program.
Hello, Caroline. Thank you.
You are more than welcome. Your book, Loving an Addict, Loving Yourself, you've just done a great work with that book, I want to tell you.
Thank you.
Well, you know what's good about it is it's extremely practical. Mm. And what I love is that you set up the whole story with your own story of addiction, which we're going to get into, because people love to hear a little bit of background. And it's no wonder that with this kind of a background, you have found your way into counseling, into, you know, your degree in social work and writing, and you've got a wonderful website, CandacePlator.com, CandacePlator.com, where people can go, and you've got great articles and tips. And so give us a little bit about how you actually got into this yourself.
Okay. But what I'll say is that actually I have a master's in clinical counseling.
It's clinical counseling. Well, you know what? I like that even better.
Yeah. Well, it's very interesting. I was diagnosed with Crohn's disease in 1973. And at that point, I was in my early 20s. And at that time, the medical establishment did not have a clue about how to treat Crohn's, about what to do with it at all. They knew about colitis, but they didn't know about Crohn's, which is basically the same illness, but in a different part of the body and requires different foods, different medications. So they had me on the wrong medications for a year. And then after becoming very, very sick, what they decided to do for me was just give me as many painkillers as I wanted, as much Valium as I
mm-hmm.
wanted. So for years and years and years, I took those medications quite faithfully and developed addiction to basically all of them.
Wow. And of course, that renders one completely, you know, I wouldn't want to say unstable, but really unable to make rational decisions because one is medicated.
Yeah.
Therefore, you were certainly not yourself during those years.
Well, I wasn't myself, but, you know, at that point, I really didn't have too much of a clue mm-hmm. who myself was.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
But, yeah, it very much numbed me out. I was able to maintain a life. I was able to work and that kind of thing. But if you fast forward 14 years, At that point, I was so depressed from all these drugs because what they gave me, you know, Valium and codeine and Demerol and those kinds of drugs are all depressants. And I was also using pot. So that helps the pain as well. Like, I can really understand about medical marijuana, but it's still addictive and it still numbs you out. So all of these drugs were depressants for me, and I became very, very depressed. And that's when I pretty much reached the bottom for myself, was I became suicidal. I started feeling like I just didn't want to go on the way I was living. I didn't really want to die, and that's what I know about people who are suicidal, is that most of them don't want to die. They just don't want to live the way they've been living.
Yeah.
And that was me. So at that point, I reached out for help.
Gosh, that's amazing. So in what form did that help come?
Well, I initially called a crisis line, and they referred me to a place called SAFER here in Vancouver, which is a suicide prevention counseling service, which was just wonderful. And, you know, it just, and then I started going to 12-step programs, which I went to for many years. It was just an amazing, amazing journey, quite painful emotionally.
And but you know what's really interesting about it, the outcome of this, and you don't you find that people really find their purpose and get in touch with their purpose in life through their own pain, through their own health, journey to health and recovery? I mean, I just really think it just is, it's almost the universe's way of saying, here, you know, you go through this and then you can help others.
I totally agree with you. It doesn't work that way for everybody, unfortunately, but it definitely worked that way for me. Yeah.
Oh, that's so fantastic.
And actually, now, this coming Sunday, I celebrate 23 years clean and sober, so I'm very happy to be talking about this.
That's wonderful. But you didn't? Did you have an alcohol addiction as well, or was that part of it?
Well, I didn't really have an alcohol addiction because alcohol hurt my stomach so much when I drank. But if I didn't have the drugs I needed, I would drink it anyway.
Mm.
And that's, you know, that's how much pain I was in emotionally and physically, is that I would try something that I knew would hurt me even more.
Isn't
so addiction,
that something?
You know, addiction is a very dicey kind of thing.
Yes, and really one feels so powerless to be able to get out of it. And I think really having that spiritual connection is something that really gives us. And, you know, the 12-step programs are very good for that, having a spiritual connection and really believing in a higher power and asking that higher power to help and taking those steps, you know, the 12 steps with other people in the groups.
Yeah.
And just asking, you know, the universe, the higher power, please, you know, intercede on this behalf and help with this whole thing.
Mm-hmm. What we know today is that, you know, the 12-step programs don't work for everyone, but there are many, many ways, if that's not a fit for anybody who's listening, there are many ways to access that kind of spiritual awareness and understanding and to find out what it is that your belief system is and what makes sense to you. So my hope is that anybody would want to find that inside of themselves, because I agree that is the key to getting out of all of this.
I think with any challenge, if one believes that there is a higher power, if there is some kind of universal force, God, spirit, whatever you might want to call it, I think it's tremendously helpful, and we can see it demonstrated. I mean, you and I, the way we met, I should just tell listeners the way how we met. A very lovely, wonderful couple came to Bellingham, Washington. Gosh, it's got to be 3 years ago now, isn't it?
Something like almost
something
three.
Something like that.
I think it's almost three.
To my training that I did in the fall of, well, anyway, whatever, 3 years ago, probably 2007. And then I got an email, or I got a call from the gal maybe a few days later after it was finished, and she said she had a friend who'd been in Extremis with Crohn's, you know, for many, many years, and would I be able to help? And because we were both in the same city at that time, I said, certainly, and you and I met, I believe, did we meet in Whole Foods or something?
We met at Whole Foods, but first I had listened to one of your radio...
That was it.
Telephone conferences, yeah.
And we had just an instant, wonderful connection, and in fact, we've ended up becoming very close friends, and you very kindly have helped at a number of our events that we've done in Vancouver, and have, I'm sure, learned more over the last few years of us being together. And in fact, I don't want to put words in your mouth. I do believe that your Crohn's symptoms are pretty much, you know, I wouldn't want to say a thing of the past, but certainly under control.
Much more so.
Yeah, and that's really wonderful, and I think that is the power of this very unseen force that appears to be guiding us at all times in our life. And if we honor that and realize that serendipity is not necessarily a mysterious thing, that there's a timing for everything. And I would say, for everybody listening, a timing, you know, to find the right practitioner, to find the right tools, and not to give up on oneself, and to say, you know what, there's got to be an answer, there's got to be a solution.
Mm-hmm.
And I think your book, Loving an Addict, Loving Yourself, really gives very practical guidelines, you know, step one, two, three, here's how I felt, here's what happened, and really, you know, is a huge tool and a great assist for people. So let's get into the meat of the book,
okay.
And people are interested in this.
Okay.
And now, how do you know if someone that you love, because this is your, you know, loving an addict, how do you know if that person that you love dearly is an addict? What would be some of the things we'd be looking out for?
Well, first of all, I want to say that when similar to what you said in the beginning, when I'm talking about an addict or an addiction, I'm talking about an addictive behavior across the board. So
mm-hmm.
I'm talking about alcohol and drug use, and I'm talking about eating disorders, gambling, smoking, internet addiction, where, you know, people are playing video games for hours or watching porn, sex addiction, relationship, codependency, that kind of thing. So for me, addiction is addiction, and the reasons that people get into addiction, basically the reason is that they want to change how they're feeling.
Yes.
And
placate
most people,
that little child who's not happy.
Right. The inner
mm-hmm.
child stuff is so important, and I work with that a lot with my clients.
Mm-hmm.
Most people want to change the quote-unquote negative kinds of feelings. So if they're feeling angry or sad or scared, they might use some kind of behavior or substance to not have to feel that way. Although there are other people who, you know, if they're feeling too happy, they're going to use something to change how they feel too, because inside they don't believe that they deserve to feel that good.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to sabotage that. So that's, to me, that's basically what addiction is about. And your question of how do we know that someone is addicted or becoming addicted, we all have some addictive behaviors. Mine now is that I want to reach for the chocolate every time I'm feeling something I don't want to feel.
No.
Oh, I know. I have to be really careful not to do that, but that's always my first inclination, you know. Let me change what I feel.
Mm-hmm.
We all have those things. Everybody has those things.
Mm-hmm.
But when those behaviors or those substances really begin to interfere with a person's life and with their relationship, maybe jeopardizing their job, that kind of thing, that's when we know that there's a great potential for addiction. And addiction is also, just the very nature of it, is progressive, which means that it'll start out with a little bit. It'll start out with somebody maybe enjoying a poker game with their buddies
mm-hmm.
every once in a while, maybe once a week, and then they're finding themselves at the casino every weekend, and then they find themselves there every day, and their job's in jeopardy, and they have no money to pay the rent, and, you know, that's what happens with addiction. Or somebody's using a line or two of cocaine at a party every once in a while, and then begins to use it every weekend, and then begins to use it daily. And it begins to have a terrible effect on the person's life. That's addiction.
And so when we see that in a family member, what are we going to do about that?
Well, there are a few things that people need to do about that. One, I think the major thing is that people need to face the reality of what's going on. So many people want to go into denial about that and to say to themselves, well, you know, it's not really that bad.
Yeah.
You know, so-and-so's life is worse than mine, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And really, it is that bad. If it's that bad, it's that bad. And
yeah.
we need to face that and start getting some help. the other thing that people need to look at is whether they're helping the addict or with their own behaviors, or whether they're enabling the addict. And there's a really big difference between helping and enabling. What I find so often with people is that they don't really know the difference. And people who love addicts, bless their hearts, they just love their addicted loved ones so much. They want to do basically anything they can to help them.
Yeah.
And a lot of time they're feeling really frustrated and really desperate and really powerless and hopeless, and they just want to do anything they can to make it better, and they wind up doing a lot of the wrong things that are actually causing the addiction to continue, which is what I call enabling behavior.
So do you think if, for example, it was, let's say a husband or a spouse who was gambling,
mm-hmm.
and that was very clearly recognized by, you know, the other spousal member. Now, so you have to get help from an outside source to confront that person, or do you confront that person and then they say, well, I'll stop and I'll just go once a week? Or, I mean, you know, this is really tricky because it's either, you know, it can make or break a relationship.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, people can do what they can try different things, and they can try to talk to their spouse and see whether he or she will listen. And, you know, but if they're already caught up in the throes of addiction, it's going to be really difficult for, you know, the addict to want to stop. The problem is that when loved ones are enabling the addict, and basically what that means is that they're not holding the addict accountable at all. There are no consequences for the addict. There's no reason for the addict to stop.
To stop, yeah.
Right? So there need to be some consequences. There need to be that. So that's the other thing that loved ones need to do is to learn how to set really clear, assertive boundaries,
right.
appropriate boundaries, and learn how to maintain those boundaries, because addicts will try to test those boundaries.
Candace, hold on 1 second. We're going to go to a commercial break, and we'll be right back.
If you're enjoying The Body Knows, Ask a Medical Intuitive with health expert Caroline Sutherland, you'll want to find out more. Visit Caroline's website for a complete listing of Caroline's Body Knows books, CDs, DVDs, and angel dolls for children. You'll also find a complete listing of all the supplements, appetite suppressant drops, and other products that Caroline mentions during her show. You'll find it all at carolinesutherland.com. That's carolinesutherland.com.
Everybody, welcome back to The Body Knows. It's my privilege to have Candace Platter, who's a counselor of great skill, and she's also an author. She's the author of Loving an Addict, Loving Yourself, and we're talking about enabling somebody in our lives who might have addictive behaviors, seemingly small things, and other very, you know, serious, large addictions that are really pervasive in our society. And we're talking about the whole concept of enabling as opposed to helping, and consequences. And Candace was just mentioning about setting boundaries that are real and that are firm and fixed, and discussing some of these consequences. What would those be, for example?
Well, it would depend on where the addiction is and what's happening. But, for example, one thing I see is that loved ones of drug addicts or alcoholics will lend money, will give money, sometimes not even lend, will give money to addicts. That's not a good thing to do, because we know what that money is going to be used on.
Really?
So one boundary would be, no, I'm not giving you any more money.
Mm-hmm. And then the person would start, then they could get, you know, they might get violent, they might just sort of storm off.
Mm-hmm.
All these sorts of things could happen.
Yeah, and I think people are afraid of setting those kinds of boundaries for fear of that behavior that you mentioned. But if that is not done, there's no way that anything is going to change.
Yes.
So if they think that somebody is going to become violent, then I would suggest that there is some sort of an intervention where there's a mediator, there's somebody who's professionally trained who will help them along, or call the police.
Exactly.
Call the police.
Now, let's say, for example, something that seems to be really on the rise, and I've been reading quite a lot about it, and that is, people texting, text messaging, and on the internet, and seemingly benign activities, not pornographic, but just really kind of cutting out, tuning out, not being part of the family or the scene, and just being overly involved and spending hours on the internet and all this texting. Now, would the solution there to be taking away the computer, for example?
Well, if the person doing that is a child, if the person doing that is living in your home even as an adult, if that person, if you're the one responsible for the computer, I would say absolutely take it away. If it's an adult, they have the right to make that decision. Adults have the right to make the decision to become involved in addiction. There's really not a whole lot we can do about that. One of the basic things that I talk about in my book is learning how to shift your attention and your focus away from the addict's addiction and start focusing more on your own life.
Yes.
I think that is my basic message, because we cannot control or fix another person.
Yes.
We can set consequences for our children, and yes, if our child is on the computer way too much, then something needs to be done about that, and boundaries and limits need to be set about that. But if the person is an adult, they have the right to make their choices, and we need to focus on our own lives. We need to, in essence, say to that person, I love you so much. I love you so much that I am not willing to watch you destroy yourself. So if you're going to choose to destroy yourself, you need to go someplace else and do that. If you want to recover, I'm absolutely here for you to help.
That's very good, because as the spouse, the other partner, develops their own strengths, their own confidence, their own sense of themselves, which, of course, very much the personal development path is, that's what it's all about. As each person develops their own strengths, then, they don't really attract somebody with an addictive personality to lean on them. They don't attract that kind of person into their lives.
I absolutely agree with you, and it's amazing, how many people do attract addicts into their lives because of what they grew up with, coming from an alcoholic home, or learning that when the going gets tough, the tough go shopping. It's the coping mechanisms that we learned as children that we continue in our adult lives, and sometimes it's the abuse that we suffered as children that we somehow find a way to continue in our own lives.
Yeah.
In our adult lives. So what needs to happen is that we have to heal that part of ourselves, that inner child part of ourselves, and make a different decision about how we deserve to be treated and develop our self-respect, which to me it's different than self-esteem. It's just a little bit different. Self-respect, to me, is probably the most important thing we have or don't have. We can't buy it anywhere. Nobody can give it to us. It's an inside job, and we have to develop it ourselves. And once we do that, we're teaching other people how to treat us, as Dr. Phil says, right? So if we're not treating ourselves respectfully, if we're not believing in our own self-respect, why should anybody else respect us? And when we start to respect ourselves and behave differently with different boundaries, other people just naturally start to treat us differently.
Yeah.
I have lived without self-respect. I now have self-respect, and there's no question for me which is better.
Absolutely, and it's quite a quest, and it's quite a journey. I must say now, and we haven't really talked about this, in sort of our preamble and our earlier discussions, but I am very interested in the type of therapy, and one of the types of therapies I'm sure that you use with clients is called EMDR,
yes.
Eye Movement Desensitization and Repatterning. Tell the listeners a little bit about what EMDR is, and I know there's a website, emdr.com, and just talk a little bit about that form of therapy, and and why it's so successful.
Okay, I'll try. EMDR is a hard thing to talk about in words because I shouldn't say nobody is quite sure how it works. I'm not quite sure how it works. I know it does work. I think people who are studying the brain are learning more about how it works and why it works. But what EMDR really is bilateral stimulation of the brain, which means that you're stimulating both sides of your brain, the left brain, the right brain, right brain, back and forth, one then the other. You're stimulating both sides of the brain. So when therapists use EMDR, it's called eye movement because many therapists who use it will hold up fingers or their hands and move them back and forth from side to side, and then the client follows that person's hand back and forth. So the eyes are going back and forth, side to side. So that stimulates both sides of the brain. There are other ways to do it. What I prefer to do is tapping on the knees. So it's tap one knee, tap the other knee, tap one knee, tap the other knee, and it's just tapping back and forth. I like this method because I can be closer physically to the client if they're okay with that. And they can also keep their eyes closed. And sometimes having one's eyes closed during this creates just a deeper level of what they're looking at for themselves.
Well, you know, I think it's a very effective method, and whether it be tapping or fingers or using a light bar or whatever it is, I really encourage people to investigate it because in my view, and I'm sure you'll agree, there's almost nothing that is as effective and as the word quick, I mean, you know, I don't like to use that word, but
yeah, it's not a magic wand.
But it is very effective for
it's
releasing
very effective. And
old
what it does,
rooted
what it does,
patterns.
What it does somehow, Caroline, is that it helps people go back into what's happened to them so that they can reprocess it without becoming re-traumatized by it.
Yes, that's
and
key.
Say that again.
I think that's very important.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure exactly how that happens, but, you know, people, when you're doing EMDR as a client, you can become emotional. You can be crying when you're going through some of the stuff that, you know, some of your childhood stuff, whatever, but it's not the same as talking about
it. Talk therapy.
Yeah, it's not the same as talk therapy sometimes. That can be re-traumatizing.
Yeah.
Sometimes it isn't re-traumatizing, but it can be. EMDR usually bypasses that in people. And so it is faster, and it's gentler.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I can think of two specific occasions when I've used EMDR, and one was a traumatic experience that I had when I was very, very sick as a little girl in Africa. And I've always been afraid of large dogs because I nearly died, and outside our home where my room was in Africa when I grew up as a little girl in Kenya, when my father was a doctor there, I was very sick, and outside the wall of my bedroom, I could hear hyenas literally growling outside that wall, waiting
to
devour this little kid who was, you know, lying in bed with a temperature of 105. And so I had some EMDR around that, and literally, my experience of it is, you go in and work with a therapist such as yourself, and you have this nugget that you go in, here's the thing that you're going to clear, and the therapist, of course, you know, works it so beautifully and makes it easy. And I couldn't really remember how I felt about that. In other words, there was no charge. There was no charge left on that issue. And I loved that about EMDR, that there was literally no charge.
And that doesn't always happen after the first session. Sometimes it takes a little while for it to happen, but it does happen, and it happens usually faster than by talking it out.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, that's so great. Now, let's go back to, you've got the idea of, can you ever really live a good life with an addict in it? And I think the answer to that is going to be probably not if the addict goes and dives back into the same behaviors again.
Oh, you know what? I really disagree.
Okay, good.
I think absolutely, a person can live a really good life even if you have an addict in your life who continues to use.
Well, give us an example.
Well, but the what needs to be done is, again, that shift needs to happen so that you're not addicted to the addict's addiction.
Okay.
If you stay addicted to the addict's addiction, you're down there with the addict in addiction. But if you set boundaries with the addict about, you know, if you know, for example, as a therapist, I have a boundary that if somebody has had anything to drink use 24 hours before a session, I don't want them to come. Because I don't want to be with them if they've got that substance in them.
Yes.
So that's one kind of boundary that can be set. You know, if you're still using, then I'm not going to be seeing you. When you're ready to stop, you can come back into my life.
Well, that's great. That's a good way of saying it. You want to do that? Well, you know, have fun doing that,
but
I'm over here.
You go ahead and do that.
Mm-hmm,
you just do it someplace else.
Mm-hmm,
you don't do it near me. And
right.
In the meantime, I'm going to find out who I am.
Yes.
And I'm going to live my life, and I'm going to develop my spiritual side, and I'm going to heal my inner child and figure out why I needed to attract you in the first place.
Yes.
You know, and, you know, so absolutely people can live a good life. Yeah.
Even with that addict in them,
yeah,
in their
absolutely.
Life.
Absolutely. Yep. Yep. As long as they are willing to look at themselves and do what they need for themselves.
Yes.
Yes.
Now, in speaking about addiction, I know from my own experience as a young woman, I was very addicted to sugar. I was very addicted to coffee. I was very addicted to chocolate, those three things. I have never been, fortunately, to alcohol or recreational drugs, been addicted to those. But I would placate my inner child with literally eating.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, I had the type of metabolism where I did gain weight, but I didn't gain very much. I mean, not enough to be popping out of my clothes, but it was always frustrating. I was always on a diet. Goodness knows how many diets I was on. Fortunately, all of this cleared up when I turned 39 and found out that all the foods that I was addicted to, so when you translate it into food, the foods that the person's addicted to, they're actually allergic to, and it's called an addictive allergic response. It's like a wheel. And when they don't have the food, i.e. chocolate, they'll go into withdrawal, and they'll start to have a headache, or they'll start to feel, you know, some odd symptoms, and they have to dive right back into the chocolate again. It's like an alcoholic. They have to have the alcohol, or they'll go into withdrawal. So from that perspective, I know in my own life what that was all about, and that was, you know, the usual unhappiness, and, of course, blaming everybody else. You know how people with addictions often will blame everyone else without turning the finger back on themselves.
Yeah, there's a kind of a not so funny joke kind of in Alcoholics Anonymous. That, you know, people say, "Well, you'd drink too if you had a wife like mine."
Oh yeah.
Well, you know, that's crazy. That's not why a person is drinking. A person is drinking alcoholically because, number one, they've got an allergy to the substance, and number two, they don't want to take responsibility and look at their own lives. They don't want to take a look at themselves. So anybody who isn't ready to take a look at themselves is going to have to blame somebody else.
That's right.
But what you're talking about in terms of the food addiction, whether it's a mind-altering addiction like alcohol and drugs, or it's a mood-altering addiction like sugar or caffeine or different foods, in order to stop using those things, especially if we have allergies to them, we have to learn how to be uncomfortable. We have to give ourselves permission to be uncomfortable for a while.
Yeah.
And when I was in detox coming off Valium 23 years ago, this month actually, I thought I was going crazy. I thought I was losing my mind. And I developed, with the help of whatever my higher power is, I developed a little mantra that I would say. And I would say to myself, "This feels wrong, but it's right. This feels so wrong. This withdrawal, it feels so wrong, but it's right."
That's good.
And so that really helped me to be able to keep going and put one foot in front of the other, because it's the right thing to do for ourselves. It's the self-respecting, self-loving thing to do for ourselves, but we have to be willing to be uncomfortable for a little while, whether we're the addict or whether we're the loved one of the addict.
Yes, it's that self-respecting thing. It's, in other words, taking charge, saying there is another way. I want to be healthy. I want to be free of this.
Yes. And on top of that, the most loving thing that we can do for our addicted loved ones is to start setting boundaries with them and
yes.
start saying no to them. It is the most loving thing we can do.
Mm. Because it will help them. We change and then they change.
Yes. Most of the time.
Yes.
There are times when we change and they don't change. So don't do it just for that reason. But most of the time, the ripple effect is that the addict will look at, you know, the loved one and say, oh, they're doing something different. They don't have the time for me that they used to. They're not addicted to my addiction anymore.
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
What about something like domestic abuse? You know, I look at that and it just baffles me. Spousal abuse where there's a lot of yelling and possibly mm-hmm. hitting and this
yep.
and that. And then the other spouse is cowering in the corner and they have this kiss and make up thing.
Yeah.
And then it starts again. I mean, I just cannot get my mind around that.
Mm-hmm. It's a very sad situation, and it usually happens because of low self-esteem and low self-respect.
Mm-hmm.
Because
you mean the person who's being abused, and even both people, I would think.
Both of them, yeah. Well, we know now that people who offend have been offended.
Yes.
So, you know, if we take the classic male abuser and the classic female victim,
yes,
the man was more than likely bullied and abused, maybe by his own father.
Yes.
Or by somebody else, he wasn't protected from it. And he learned that power lies in that kind of, you know, bullying.
Yes.
That kind of aggression. And then we see the victim, the woman who maybe came from the same kind of household. Maybe her mother had been abused, or she just really doesn't believe in herself at all, and she's so grateful that somebody else could love her, and
yes.
this is what she thinks love is and doesn't know any different, and so it just goes on and on.
But don't you think it's interesting? I mean, just something really simple. I did a reading for a client not that long ago in Los Angeles, for example, and we were talking about food, and she was just baffled that I would, you know, suggest that she might make a meal. And she was married to a busy executive, and she had a 12-year-old son. And I said, well, you do cook, don't you? You do have a stove. And she said, well, you know, we have a stove here, and we've been here for 8 years, but I've never really used the stove apart from making a cup of tea or, you know, pot of coffee. And all of a sudden I realized her son, her 12-year-old, had been watching her his whole life. And I said, well, you know, your son has been watching you, and more than likely he will bring you home in another form. He will bring a woman home who doesn't respect herself, and the fact that food is nurturing and important, who doesn't respect her family enough to, you know, create some kind of a meal with their, you know, support and help. And she was absolutely stunned when she realized that she was literally patterning the next generation.
Absolutely. Happens all the time.
Yes. Now, you've got this great book. I love it. Loving an Addict, Loving Yourself. And you've got 10 top survival tips. Let's see how many we can go through before the end of the program.
Okay. I can tell you the ones that I think are the most important. I mean, I think they're all important, but I can tell you which ones I think are probably the most important to people, if you like.
Sure.
Okay. I think the first one is it's survival tip number 3, and I'm just getting my book out here so I can quote it right.
You're like me. I get interviewed. Now, on page 69, you say this and that. I'm thinking, what did I write on page 69?
Yeah, exactly. Survival tip number 3, you cannot control or fix another person, so
mm-hmm.
stop trying.
Yes.
And there's a quote that I have. I have a quote for each chapter, for each tip. And this one, I just love it. It's my favorite. Never try to teach a pig to sing. It's a waste of your time, and it annoys the pig. So
that's
we need
right.
to stop trying to teach our addicts to sing. You know, we have to stop trying to make them stop.
Yes.
We have to stop trying to, we need to say to them, look, if you want to stop, if you really want to stop, I am here to help you 100%. If you are not here to stop, then go do it somewhere else, because I'm not doing this anymore with you.
Yes. Yes,
and so
that's
to
good.
Me, that's, you know, and learning the difference between helping and enabling, that's the second one that I think is the most important one. That's survival tip number 5. And
so learn and know the difference, and you've been and in your book you talk about those differences. You spend a lot of time on that.
I do. I talk a lot about the difference between helping and enabling, because so often the loved ones of addicts don't know the difference, and there are very few resources for people in that situation. There are very few therapists like myself who specialize in this. There are very few self-help groups. There's Al-Anon, there's Nar-Anon, those 12-step programs. They don't work for everyone. They're wonderful, but they don't work for everyone.
Yes.
And there's just not very much out there. So learning the difference between whether you're being willing to take a look at your own behaviors in this situation and whether your own behaviors are healthy or not.
Exactly.
And whether your own behaviors are going to help your addict, your addicted loved one, or whether they're going to hurt him or her.
Make it worse.
Yeah.
Exactly. So give us some more tips.
The next one would be survival tip number 8, and that is know that self-care does not equal selfish.
Right.
And especially for women, it's true for some men as well, depending on how they've been brought up, but most men are socialized a little differently and wired a little differently. But for most women, we are taught that we're supposed to be the ones that make our relationships work, that we're supposed to give and give and give and give until we're absolutely depleted. And what I'm saying is, no, don't do that. And then if you've been a woman, if you've been a person who has been giving and giving and you stop doing that, the people in your life will probably come to you and say, how can you be so selfish? How can you be so selfish to look after yourself first? But, you know, there's a great analogy that I use in my book for anybody who's been in an airplane, that when we start to take off, you know, the dreaded speech from the flight attendant about if we run into difficulties and the masks come down.
Yes.
Make sure, what do they say? They say make sure.
You put your own
mask on first.
Before you help someone
and
else.
And why is that? Because if we try to put somebody else's mask on when we can't breathe, we're not going to get very far.
Yes.
So for me, this is an analogy of life. If you can't breathe, don't try to help somebody else breathe.
Right.
You learn how to breathe yourself. Learn how to take care of yourself.
Absolutely. Now, you know, I'm going to just mention something. I'm in my second marriage now, happily married now for 5 years, a little bit more than that. But what I found really interesting in my first marriage is when I really looked to see what was going on and I pulled my energy out, in other words, worked more on my own self-esteem, self-respect, and worked on myself, I observed that literally, and this was scary, but I was at the point where I had to face it, there was no energy in that marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And that was interesting. I'd been propping that thing up, doing, you know, putting out, let's change this, let's change that. And when I literally stopped, I'm looking after me, I'm looking after, you know, the deeper part of my being, and there was literally nothing there.
Yes, and some people are afraid, this is such a good point you're raising, some people are afraid to do their deep inner work, to do their recovery work, because they're afraid of how it's going to affect their lives in those kinds of ways.
Yes.
Because, you know, people can do this dance of dysfunction for a really long time. People, it amazes me that people can stay together for, you know, 50 years in a marriage that's really toxic, and people will throw them a party. Say, isn't it wonderful that they stayed together for 50 years?
Yeah.
But they don't really know what's going on behind closed doors.
Maybe
but
that was a little bit like that, you know, the Al Gore marriage. I was wondering about
Maybe. We don't know what was going on there. But, you know, what happens is that when you've got this kind of situation, this kind of addiction in a relationship, whatever kind of addiction it is, and one person starts to recover and the other person doesn't,
mm-hmm.
like you started looking after yourself and your husband didn't,
yeah.
What happens is the person looking after herself just totally outgrows the other person.
Yes, yes. Yeah,
you know, and if both people are in recovery of some sort, then you've got a chance of that working. But sometimes even then, if both people, you know, if your husband had gone to therapy, for example, and you were doing what you were doing to take care of yourself and your husband had gone to therapy, you still could have gotten to a place of looking at each other and saying, you know, I'm not so sure I want to stay here.
Yes.
So Sometimes that happens too. But the most important thing is that we need to look after ourselves. It's our first job, and it's we're the only ones who can do it for ourselves.
Yes.
And it's a wonderful, I mean, the outcome is amazing. You would not have wanted to know me 23 years ago, you know. I wasn't.
Well, you're delightful now. I can't imagine you wouldn't have been delightful then.
No, I was not delightful then. I didn't like myself. I didn't respect myself. And the difference from doing this inner work, it's just so, it's the most amazing journey you can ever go on.
Oh, yes. The inner journey is really a wonderful one, you know, from the head to the heart, from the the loss and the pain to feeling, you know, a life of joy and a life of abundance, and it mm-hmm. just comes, it's just so rich once we get a handle on who we are and what we're here to do, and start
feeling the effects of the work, which usually
yes.
doesn't take people very long. It doesn't take long to feel those effects.
Yes.
And to be doing this holistically.
Yeah.
So, you know, to be looking at the physical and to be physical self-care, to be doing the kinds of things that you advocate that really work. I mean, I know firsthand how much they work. Thank you so much.
You're
you know,
welcome.
I say that to you over and over again because you really changed my life in terms of the food and that kind of thing. So, looking after oneself in a physical way, exercising, dressing yourself nicely, taking care of yourself, and doing the emotional work that it takes, going to see somebody, seeing a therapist if you need to, or joining a support group, or talking to your religious advisor, or doing what you need to do for yourself emotionally, mentally keeping yourself on track, you know, take a class, learn a language, do some puzzles, keep yourself active mentally.
Yeah.
And not just for the older people, but for younger people as well. Keep yourself mentally active.
And also to be creative as well, because creativity
yeah.
is so healing. I just, we have so little time left. I just want to make sure that people know that your book is called Loving an Addict, Loving Yourself. And I think it's on Amazon, isn't it, Candace?
Well, it's in a lot of places now. It's on Amazon. It's
good.
On Barnes & Noble.
Great.
You can get it through my website as well.
CandaceBlatter.com, that's right.
CandaceBlatter.com.
And if you're anywhere near Vancouver, BC,
yes,
and you want
yes,
to witness EMDR and see just how marvelous it is, I think you could really benefit from having a session with Candace.
Thank you, Caroline. Can I just say that it's also
yes.
in Odin Books and it's in Banyan Books now.
Oh, that's
so
wonderful.
If you're in Vancouver, it's in
local bookstores.
Yeah.
That's marvelous. Well, you know, it's just a start for you. I know one book and there'll be, a workbook and other things because it's really such a joy to share, you know, to share your experience in your brokenness and now share that with others and to help them heal and you heal yourself through that process.
It's amazing. I wish it for everyone.
You are most welcome. So my guest today has been Candace Platter. Thank you so much, everyone, for listening. This is The Body Knows. I'm your host, Caroline Sutherland. I'll see you again here at Contact Talk Radio in 2 weeks' time. Goodbye, everyone.
You've been listening to The Body Knows with medical intuitive Caroline Sutherland. Tune in again every second and fourth Tuesday of the month to hear Caroline's perspective on what your body is telling you. For more information, go to www.carolinesutherland.com. That's carolinesutherland.com.